MacCast, Monday, August 1st, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hey, I got a great show for you today. Bunch of stuff to talk about, including more rumors on the next generation iPhone. Is it going to be a 4? Is it going to be a 5? Also, iPad 3 rumors, some updates to the Apple TV, some significant new stuff in there. iFixit went under the hood of the new MacBook Air and found some interesting stuff about the Thunderbolt controller. And then also, I've got hints and tips, more stuff on Lion, a cool mail tip for you. Also, just some opinions on the Appleization of OS X. I'll explain what that means in a minute, and a really cool little Easter egg that I ran across. All that and more in this episode, but before I dive into that, let me take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, if you like it or not, I think actually parents like this time of year, but maybe the students not so much, it's back to school. And this would be a perfect time to pick up this application for your student. If you're a teacher, it's great for getting your class schedule organized, organizing all your notes and stuff like that. If you're a student, taking notes, putting in your schedules, your classes and stuff like that, you can get it all organized inside of Notebook. Have that right there on your Mac or your iPad. They have a version for the iPad, and the files transfer back and forth. But a really nice feature when you're taking course notes is the audio annotation. You can actually turn that on in Notebook and record your lecture along with taking your notes, and it will sync that stuff up. So you can jump to any point in your notes and then listen to the audio that was going on at that time or the lecture that was going on at that time. It's a really great way to fill out any missing pieces, or if you wrote something in your outline that you don't really quite understand, you forgot, and you just want a little more detail, just listen to the audio that you captured. And they just released an update for Lion compatibility, so it's fully Lion compatible. You don't have to worry about that if you upgraded. And if you'd like to try before you buy, they do have demos available. So you can go to their website, you can get more information, details. They have some great tutorials to get you up and running quickly with the software. That's at circusponies.com, so check it all out. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So rumors are still flying about the next generation iPhone. They seem to be all over the place in terms of, one, the release date, and also whether or not it's going to be an iPhone 5 or an update to the iPhone 4. It's jumping back and forth. The rumor sites are going a little bit crazy. They seem a little schizophrenic, if you ask me. But the latest rumors on the iPhone 4 is that it's really just an update to a less expensive version. Something to compete with the lower priced smartphones that are coming out on the market from Apple's competitors. The reason for this rumor, mainly triggered by the surfacing of some images from a Vietnamese website that's had legitimate Apple leaked product images in the past. This time around, they were showing a white model iPhone with the glass front and back panels replaced by cheaper plastic ones. Really what it ended up looking like, though, is just a cheap knockoff kit, a white iPhone knockoff kit from China. I really don't put a lot of stake in Apple wanting to do a cheaper version of the iPhone 4 or an iPhone 4S or 5 or whatever you want to call it. I think that they're going to stick with their old plan when they release the new model of just having the current generation model, the lowest end iPhone 4, become the new entry point model, just like they did with the iPhone 3GS. You can get the 8GB iPhone 3GS for $49, maybe even cheaper. I have a little story on that there in a second. But iPhone 4S, I'm just really not buying it. I think Apple's going to jump right to the iPhone 5, and we did hear some more about the iPhone 5 this week, mainly surrounding when the release date was going to happen. If you remember, AT&T employees, or there had been a rumor that AT&T employees had been notified that they weren't able to take any vacation time toward the end of September, that they were expecting a lot of traffic in-store and that they would need all employees on hand to staff the retail stores. And that usually has happened when Apple has done releases of new iPhones. They've staffed up the AT&T stores to make sure that they have enough people on hand to kind of handle the demand, the push of that sort of stuff. So everybody had been thinking September release time. That also coincides with Apple's fall event. So big announcement, new iPhones. Yes, they're on sale now. You can go out and get them. Well, this week, D All Things Digital started reporting that October was actually the release date of the iPhone 5 and not September, that their sources are saying it's going to be in October. There had been some supporting evidence earlier in the week because AT&T confirmed that it's planning to start data throttling its very heavy iPhone users in the U.S. starting the first week of October. This is on all current and new unlimited data plans. So I don't know if you can get a new unlimited data plan, but the current, if you one of those people with an iPhone that's grandfathered in on the unlimited data plan and you're a really heavy data user, I guess what's going to happen is once you go over a threshold, and we don't know what that is, they're not going to cut your service off. They're going to still allow you to have unlimited, but they're going to severely slow down, or at least partially slow down, your download speeds. Verizon started doing this in February 2011, and it's to alleviate network traffic on the 3G networks for heavy data users. So Verizon started in February. Virgin Mobile announced that they were doing a similar thing, starting, interestingly enough, also in October. In the case of Virgin, what they'll do is they'll run you down to 256 kilobits per second on your downloads. Now, I think typical AT&T 3G download speeds run around 300, 400 kilobits per second. So if they throttle you down that much, that's not really going to be much of a throttle. But AT&T has announced, and it was confirmed, that they were going to do that. So this is also supporting this rumor that October might be the time when new iPhones are coming out, which is why AT&T is kind of rejiggering their policies. Also, there's been a rumor that AT&T will reprice their phone insurance policies at that time too. So that's the like accidental damage coverage and stuff like that. And that usually coincides with the release of some major new hardware. So I'm starting to believe the D All Things Digital report that October might be when we see that new hardware coming out, and we'll have to stay tuned for that. As far as what the new hardware will actually be, a bunch of websites, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and This Is My Next, which is Joshua Topolsky from Engadget's blog or new website venture, have all reported similar rumors surrounding the design of the new iPhone 5. In essence, it's going to be slightly larger, about 5 inches tall by 2.8 inches wide. And the theory here is so that it can accommodate a slightly larger screen. We've been hearing up to 4 inches on the screen size, which would kind of match a lot of the other competitive G4 or 3G and 4G phones that are out on the market right now. They are going to try and offset, I think, that size difference, because it in your hand, it does significantly feel larger when you start changing the height and width of the device. I think they're going to try and offset that with a newer, slimmer design. The design is partially going to be helped by having tapered edges. So a lot of the early case designs that we've been seeing leaked supposedly for the new iPhone 5 are showing the kind of tapered edge, more like, think like your MacBook Pro or the MacBook Air, or probably more accurately, kind of like the iPod Touch and the iPad 2. And then there's also some indication that the whole back design will be a metal design. I don't know what that means for the antennas and the antenna issues. Apple used on the current iPhone 4 that metal band as the actual antenna, but I don't think there's going to be any seams if they have this tapered kind of metal back. So maybe they'll move them up behind the glass like they've done with the antennas for wireless in the iMacs and stuff like that, and maybe even use the logo on the back to allow some antenna transparency, and they hide the antennas inside there, the little plastic inset logo, so they can do that also. Another not as significant change, but still noteworthy, is that the design has the mute switch moved to the other side of the phone, so opposite from the volume controls, and that is shown in these case designs that we're seeing coming out of Asia. Of course, along with these latest rumors, you have all the rumors of upgraded camera, probably 8 megapixels, possibly a second flash, although I haven't heard that one rumored in a while, so that may have gone the way of the dodo, and also upgraded processor, graphics processor, things like that. So those are all in line, slated for the next update. As far as the current phones, we had some interesting information come out this week. It looks like Radio Shack and Target might be getting ready to lower U.S. prices on the current devices by up to $30. A 16-gigabyte iPhone 4 for $169.99 and a 32-gigabyte model for $269.99. That is supposed to happen today or tomorrow, any day now. Also, that the iPhone 3GS would be rumored in dropping its price to $20, just $19.99 US, and all of these prices are based on signing up for a new 2-year service contract with the cell provider. But those lowering of the prices seem to indicate that Apple might be getting ready to kind of start clearing out the current lineup, maybe in preparation for that October launch of a new device. So we're going to have to wait and stay tuned, but sounds like iPhone 5 sometime this fall. What's looking less and less likely to happen this fall is a next generation iPad. There had been these rumors that Apple was working on a new HD model, maybe an iPad 3 that would be coming out in the fall with a higher resolution display, something like a Retina display. I never put much stock in those rumors. I didn't think that Apple had any real reason to rush a new iPad out to market. I don't think that the current sales are slumping, and that was evidenced by a report that came out this week from IHS, formerly iSupply. They did a study of 1,400 tablet customers, and they showed that the iPad still had 79% market share. Apple's just started to meet iPad 2 demand. You now don't have the long delays, so the devices are still selling really well. There's nobody out on the market. There's no competitors that seem to be out on the market that are challenging Apple, and I think they can wait longer, build a better iPad. They're always playing around with prototypes, so I think some of these rumors come about because Apple is checking out new screens, new technologies, and stuff like that. But that doesn't mean they have to put a new device out to market. I think it's also one of the reasons why Apple stopped doing things like Macworld. They don't have to have these major product announcements in place to meet any kind of date that anybody else gives them. They can hold a special event, send out invitations, and a lot of people are going to show up in Cupertino to see the next generation device from Apple. It might make the fall announcement a little bit light. That's typically when they do the iPods, and we are expecting an iPhone announcement, although if that's been pushed up to October, who knows what's going to go on there. But I certainly don't see any reason to rush an iPad out. When I'm out and about and looking at people who have tablets, almost exclusively it's an iPad. I don't think I've seen any other device. I haven't seen a Playbook for certain. I maybe have seen somebody with a Motorola Zoom tablet. The HP touchpad doesn't seem to be taking off really well. Probably the closest thing to a tablet that I see a lot out in the wild that isn't an iPad is actually a Nook. And that kind of coincides with some of the reports that I read and some things that analysts have said about, in order to compete with Apple's iPad right now, a competitor would need to come out with a sub-$300 tablet. And that's kind of what you have with the Nook. I think sub-$200 in the case of the Nook. And that's what it's going to take to unseat Apple's dominance. So without the threat of any competition anywhere on the horizon, and with the product that they have now selling really, really well, I think iPad 3 sometime next year, probably toward the end of the first quarter, April, May timeframe, which is when we've seen Apple bring out new iPads. There's an interesting contrast going on in terms of market share. I mentioned iPad with 79% market share on the smartphone side, at least when it comes to the operating system. But again, I'm going to go back to some of the things I've stated on the show in the past, where I don't think that for Apple, it's necessarily about market share in terms of OS or devices and things like that. I think it's more about the bottom line. And I think they make a lot of their decisions on when to release new products, when to update things based on what's going to be best for growth of the company and also what the best experience for the consumers are. But some numbers came out this week. Android smartphones reportedly have 48% of the global smartphone market share when you look purely at operating systems. So devices running the Android operating system, smartphone devices running the Android operating system. In contrast, Apple has about 19% of the market, which makes them seem like they're really far behind Android. But you have to remember that every smartphone running iOS is an Apple phone. So 19% of smartphone shipments belong to Apple. And that means, there was a contrasting report that came out, that Apple is on top in terms of handset shipments. 19% is the largest shipments. And it gets even better when you look at Apple's profit margins. Apple currently owns almost 2/3 of the global smartphone market in terms of revenue. So they're doing really, really well. I don't think they really care that their operating system isn't the dominating operating system on a smartphone device. I think that they care. They're selling a lot of phones, and iPads, and that people really like the devices. And I think they're just going to keep chugging along, doing their own thing, and not really worry about what's going on over across the way at Google or anyplace else. Now, that doesn't mean that an iPad 3 isn't in the works. Apple is, I'm sure, planning the next generation device. They're trying to figure out when it's going to come out. We heard some rumors this week that they might be using a new supplier to build the iPad 3, trying to cut costs a little bit. Pegatron has reportedly become the new manufacturer, won the bid to be the new manufacturer for the next generation iPad. I think really what might be happening is that Apple's adding Pegatron as a second supplier. They've been using Foxconn for a while. We had these reports that Foxconn's been working on building this big new plant in Brazil that would help them increase production. And I think that Apple is expecting iPad demand to really keep growing into 2012. So it wouldn't surprise me that Pegatron isn't not the exclusive supplier, that they're actually being added along with Foxconn to help kind of meet demand. The rumor was that Pegatron actually outbid Foxconn for the new iPad contract, but we'll have to see. There's been reports that it could be an added supplier rather than a totally different one. As far as the other major components on the iPad, we haven't heard any real big shakeups on that. Their same component suppliers that they're using for the iPad 2s seem to be the same ones they're going to be going with respect to a next generation device. They've continually added new suppliers to help keep up demand, which is why I think they've got a handle on the iPad 2 supply now. And I would expect that to continue as they move into making the iPad 3. So OS X Lion's been out for a couple weeks now, and we're starting to get the reports of minor bugs and issues. The most significant one that I'm hearing about is an issue where in some systems, Lion seems to be freezing when waking from sleep. I've had a couple of you tell me about this issue on your systems. The bug seems to be related to video playback and sleeping on 2011 iMacs, so the newer generation iMacs. Also, some reports that it might be happening on MacBook Pros, although I have the latest generation MacBook Pro and I haven't run across the issue. It seems to be that if you're playing video anywhere on your system in QuickTime or inside Safari, and it doesn't matter whether or not it is QuickTime video or Flash video, and your system goes to sleep, you'll try and wake it back up, and then it will just sort of freeze up and lock up, become unresponsive, and the only resolution seems to be a hard reset by holding down the power button, completely powering down your device and restarting it. So definitely annoying. It sounds like it's limited to just some specific models, and hopefully Apple will address it fairly soon with an update to the operating system. Got some interesting news about the new MacBook Airs. iFixit came through and did their typical teardown, looking at all the components, the things that Apple's using to build the new devices. They're certainly very hot. A lot of people are not hot in terms of... I just realized that sounded like I was saying that they run hot. No, hot in terms of very popular, a lot of people picking up the new 13-inch and 11-inch MacBook Airs, the Thunderbolt models. But they do have, as it turns out, a different Thunderbolt controller chip than the iMacs or the MacBook Pros that Apple's released with Thunderbolt. This new chip is reportedly called an Eagle Ridge chip, and it's actually smaller, about half the size of its bigger brother, which would make sense because you're trying to slim down that MacBook Air as much as possible. The ones in the iMacs and the MacBook Pros are reportedly called the Light Ridge chip. And besides being smaller, the other big difference is that they might be a little bit cheaper to produce, which could bode well for Thunderbolt adoption in PCs and other third-party devices where the controller chips might get a little bit expensive. So Intel, it sounds like, has an alternative chip that might meet those demands. The big difference between the two, one, there's a slight performance difference, although the reports that I'm reading are saying it really won't be noticeable by that many users. I guess if you're looking for the absolute best performance, you're going to want the Light Ridge chip. But with the Eagle Ridge chip, a little bit slower performance. And then the other big thing is that it only supports half the number of channels of the Light Ridge chip. So two bidirectional 10 gigabit per second channels versus four. And then also half the number of display output channels, meaning just one DisplayPort output channel. So I'm assuming with the MacBook Air, that means you can only hook up one external display versus two, which you could do kind of daisy chain together on an iMac or a MacBook Pro. So not a lot of big differences, and especially if you're trying to slim down your chips and get them at a cheaper cost, it's probably worth the trade-off in some cases. And obviously, Apple believes in it if they're going to put it in the new MacBook Air. Apple released today an update to the Apple TV software, bringing it up to version 4.3. You can get that on your Apple TV 2 via the software update mechanism. It adds a couple of significant new features. One is the ability to actually purchase TV shows through the Apple TV. And because the Apple TV 2 only allows for streaming, that means that those TV shows are stored within your iTunes account in the cloud and then streamed down to the device. So along with that, you get a little cloud icon in the interface to indicate when you're streaming stuff down from iTunes. And that also means that you now have access to any TV shows that you've purchased in the past through your account history. So that's going to be pretty cool. Nice little update to the Apple TV there. And then they also added Vimeo support. So if you are a Vimeo user along with YouTube and some of the other video services, you'll be able to watch that content and log into your accounts from the new Apple TV update. The unofficial Apple weblog did note that at least initially it looks like some of the TV purchased history is not showing up for some users, or at least not all of it. So I hope this is just some rollout issues. Apple did just release the update today, and hopefully they'll get that all fixed up and it'll give you access to all of your TV content. I guess the worst reason for that would be that Apple hasn't done deals with all the TV networks and they don't have access to all of the TV content to pull it back down. And then related to this, Apple did push an update to the iTunes Store that allows you to re-download purchased content inside the TV show category. So if you go into the iTunes Store within iTunes now, you'll notice there's a new purchased category. Clicking on that will allow you to see, just like they've done for music in the cloud, see all of your previous purchases and re-download any content that might not be on your current system. So you can show the option for not on this Mac and see what you haven't downloaded and re-download that to your device. I don't know. I would assume this is US only at this point. Apple typically has to do deals with all the individual countries, so it might take a while for you to get this in your country, but at least it shows that Apple's making progress toward getting access to more TV show content through the iCloud service. And related to this, it did pop up in new terms and conditions inside iTunes when I tried to re-download some TV shows. So I'm assuming that language in there is to address this new feature. Apple TVs also, just in general, seem to be selling a lot better than Apple has historically sold them in the past. Apple shipped approximately 480,000 Apple TV 2s in the second quarter, which is about a 70% year-over-year growth. You can contrast that with some reports this week from Logitech. They have a Google TV-based box called The Review. Came out this week that they're actually having return rates on those devices exceeding their sales rates. So Apple's doing pretty good in the set-top box market. Probably not as good as Roku. I've heard Roku boxes are selling really, really well, but might have a leg up on Google TV, at least at this point. As far as Apple updating the hardware anytime soon, I don't think that's going to happen. A Concord security analyst, Ming Chai Kuo, said kind of the same thing. He doesn't see Apple updating that hardware anytime this year. We still are getting those rumors. They keep resurfacing that Apple might be working on an actual HD TV. This time around, the rumor came from an analyst over at Global Equities Research. He told his investors that Apple is planning an HD TV for release sometime in March of 2012. He claims that there's going to be three different screen sizes and three different price points. We talked about this a little bit on the We Have Communicators podcast, and I really don't put any stock in Apple releasing a new HD TV. Sorry, Victor. Victor Cahiao from The Typical Mac User has held out for a long time that Apple's going to do an Apple-branded television. I just don't see any reason for Apple to enter that market. I know they're moving more into that consumer space, but I think what's more likely to happen is that Apple will actually license the Apple TV technology. This could be Apple's first time to successfully license its operating system into a device. I think they're going to let third-party manufacturers create TVs with Apple TV built in, Apple TV technology and chipsets and things like that. And I think that's how Apple gets into that sort of device, if they even want to do that. I think that even that theory is a little bit of a stretch. Apple might just stick with the simple little set-top box, especially if they can get the number of cables down. Ideally, if they can figure out a way to wirelessly connect it to your TV, maybe even the iPad becomes that gateway. I don't know, but I don't see Apple doing an HD TV, but you know, I could be wrong. So while I do think the new TV show purchases are probably, or redownloads are probably a U.S. only feature, there was good news for international iTunes customers. Finally, wow, this really took forever, but finally, you're going to have access to 90-second song previews in iTunes. You got to love the music industry on this one. We got reports this week that the United Kingdom, Ireland, France, Australia, Mexico, the Netherlands, Italy, Sweden, Luxembourg, Denmark, Switzerland, New Zealand, and Canada will all now have access to the longer 90-second song previews in iTunes. The delay is likely because Apple has to go through and they have to do deals with every individual country, with the record industry, with the labels, with the artists, and all of those countries. They have to reach agreements before they can actually roll out these features and enhancements. I don't know if that's ever going to change. What a pain, though, it has to be for Apple and the legal teams and stuff like that. And it just slows down the release of these features, unfortunately, for international customers. And I feel your pain on that, but I don't know how that's going to change anytime soon. And the same thing happening with these TV show updates. Apple's going to have to now go in and negotiate and do agreements in these individual countries to allow re-download and streaming of this TV show content. And that's going to take some time. So hopefully they'll work as quickly as possible. I think Apple wants to. I think it's in their best interest to roll this out as quickly as possible globally, especially considering the kinds of sales they're seeing internationally, which really are exceeding their U.S. sales in a lot of cases, or at least that's where majority of their growth is happening, or a lot of their growth is happening. And I think they want to roll out into those markets quickly, but it's just going to take some time. So I've been talking a lot about Lion on a number of the podcasts that I'm on. We talked about it on We Have Communicators, I believe. I did a Mac Roundtable where I discussed it, and I've done some member episodes and also the last episode of the MacCast. So I'm not sure where I registered this complaint, but you may have heard me say that, one, I really love the new mail application in Lion. I love the new layout. I love the conversations feature. There's a lot of stuff that I really like about it. But a frustration I was having was that the new three-panel view, so where you have your mailboxes and then you have the message list and then you have the message pane where the actual content is, I was frustrated that I couldn't seem to turn off the message pane. And I thought it was kind of like iOS mail, like mail on my iPad, where that's just constantly stuck open. And when I select something from the message list, it automatically displays it. And I was concerned about that for a couple of reasons. One, I have trouble because if I'm going through my mail in a list and I delete an item, it automatically jumps up to the next message, and then that message gets marked as read, which I may or may not want to happen. So the way I would normally do this in the old version of mail is I could close or hide the main message pane, and then that wouldn't trigger it as being marked as read. The other concern with this is that some spammers use the fact that you've opened or read an email to kind of validate your email address. So they just bulk spam out to a bunch of random email addresses. And if they notice, oh, these ones actually had mail that was opened, then they know, okay, those are good. We're going to keep those on our list for the future. And you end up getting more spam. So in the classic layout, the way you would do it is in that third pane, which was at the bottom. If you remember, you kind of had the list on the left, or the top, excuse me, you had your mailboxes on the left, the list at the top, and then under the list, you had the main message viewer. And at the top of that, there was this little bar with a little dot on it that you could click, and you could slide that up and down to change the size of the bottom panel or the top panel just between the two. And if you double clicked on that little area, it would actually collapse it. And I don't know why I didn't think about this, but big thanks to Mac Roundtable listener Jim for pointing this out. In Lion, with the new layout, you can actually just kind of double click on that area where that bar would be. Right now, it's just a little line to kind of the left of the main message pane. There's not really a divider bar or anything like that indicating you can click there. But if you double click on that area, it will collapse it. And you can even, as you hover over that area, you'll notice your cursor will turn to the little insertion with the double arrow pointing both directions to show that you could actually resize that area. So you can still resize that area, but there's no visual indicator to indicate that you can do that. So that's why I didn't see it. Dumb me, you know, I should have just known, oh, click in this magic area where there's nothing and stuff will happen. But regardless, I guess that's bringing out some of my other frustrations with Lion, where some user interface things are not readily obvious. And what's even funnier is when you do the double click thing and it closes or collapses that pane, pushes it all the way over to the right, then at the right hand edge, you actually get that little bar with a little dot, with a little resizing dot. But the minute you start to pull that back out, guess what? That goes away, and you just are kind of scaling the area without any kind of actual thing that you're grabbing onto. So I don't know why Apple does these things, but that's the way it works. So if you've been wondering how to kind of collapse that main message pane so that it doesn't accidentally mark stuff as read as you're going through your mail, that's how you do it. Thanks, Jim. I really, you saved me. So while the changes to OS X Mail caused some confusion in my case, in general, we've been hearing a lot about Apple and its updates to its latest applications, Final Cut 10, some of the things that they've done to update Lion, as kind of Apple trying to simplify the processes for the average user. We've heard a lot of analogies. I think because Apple said, you know what, we're going to bring some elements of iOS back into the core operating system, into Mac OS X. So the sort of dumbing down or simplification of the interface, I call it the Appleization or consumerification of the applications and the operating system. But what's happening is because Apple is changing these features, they're really kind of, I think, hiding layers. They're putting layers of simplification. We often hear about layers of complexity, but I guess in this case, it's layers of simplification over our applications, over our operating systems to make it kind of more user-friendly, I think is what Apple's thinking about. But what's happening in contrast to that is that there are some power users who are becoming really unhappy with the state of things and how Apple is doing this stuff. Most recently, this came to light for me as I was looking into OS X Lion Server. Because I'm a web developer, I was very excited about maybe getting my hands on the server tools and making it a little bit easier for me to do things like set up websites and configure my website configuration and my databases and things like that. But when I started looking into OS X Lion Server, it had only a 3-star review on the App Store, and I started reading through the reviews. And what came about is that Apple has changed Server to be more friendly for the non-power user, but as a consequence, they've removed a lot of the access to the really fine controls and configurations that power users, users of a server operating system, those things that they would actually want. So I don't know if in that case it's a good or a bad thing. We heard the whole thing about Final Cut. We don't need to rehash that, but a lot of the really pro editors are upset about some of the changes there. Apple's done a similar thing in iMovie when they made the transition from iMovie HD to the current version of iMovie. And also, you can even look at something like QuickTime 10, which used to have a lot of power user features that I really loved, QuickTime 7. And as a matter of fact, I still install QuickTime 7 on my Lion system because I need the tools and features that it had in terms of all the export functionality, all the different formats that I can work with, those sorts of things. But QuickTime 10 is kind of really user-friendly for the average person. And another example of this that you might have is Apple hiding the library folder in Mac OS X Lion from users. It's still under there. We can get at it if we're power users. We just have to know the little trick. And I think it's a hard change. These are hard changes for us geeks and power users to get used to, but we're going to have to learn the tricks, these new tricks to getting at our power tools, or understand that even if we have Server, if we really want to get to all the fine configurations, guess what? I still have to open up a terminal and tweak some text files and stuff like that. Do the really geeky stuff to get that functionality back. But I was thinking about this week, and isn't that exactly the point? Aren't we, the power users, supposed to be the people that know how to do that, those things, the little tips and tricks? We already know this stuff. And the average user, when that stuff is exposed and kind of in front of them, it's intimidating. It's a little bit scary. So I think Apple's saying, look, we're going to build an operating system for everybody else. And you geeks and nerds and power users, you can figure out this stuff. You're going to take the time to figure out that stuff. We might not like these changes, but that's the way it seems to be going. So I truly believe this is why the iPad has become such a successful device, because Apple has created a device that anybody can pick up and just start using. They really don't have to think about it. And you're protected from a lot of the little intricacies and things that are there under the hood. I also think that maybe that's why Apple hasn't worked so actively hard to shut down jailbreaks and other hackers and stuff like that, because they still want those people to be able to use the devices and get in there and do the things that they want. They're not saying that they're going to make it easy for them to do it. They're not saying that they're going to support it, but they can actually do that. And on the flip side of this, this sort of consumerization of these products is the one thing that I think that Apple's competitors are missing. And when you look at the success of the iPad, it really is a consumer-level device. And I think they want to make Macs a truly consumer-level device. I think it was always a dream of Steve Jobs. If you go back and kind of read the history, he had this idea that the Mac, the computer, was just going to be an appliance, something that you just plugged in and started using. And I think we're getting closer to that reality, even though us power users might not really like that, that we want to still do the tinkering and tweaking. Some people have drawn analogies to cars. You know, you used to be able to kind of work and tinker on your cars, but as they've gotten more sophisticated, they've become kind of more reliable, but a lot of the little stuff that you could do with them is really hidden unless you're a real true car geek. And if you're a real true car geek, you're going to go in and you're going to figure out how you can reprogram that computer, the kinds of special tools and stuff that you can get to tweak things in there. So I, for one, am trying to actually see the value in starting to do things the Apple way, this new consumer way. And it gets a little frustrating, but I've often found that the experience for me, if I kind of just give in, becomes a better one, and I become more productive at doing things on my Mac. Some good examples of this recently is I used to try and fight the file structure that Apple forced you into with iPhoto. I tried to fight the transition and loss of the timeline when moving to iMovie. I tried to fight Time Machine and why doesn't it save all my backups, or why does it work the way it is? I want it to work the way I want it to work. And when I gave in and just started using these tools the way that Apple designed them, the way that Apple said, this is how you're supposed to use it, started letting it do things like manage my stuff and my data and not trying to tweak them, my experience with those programs became better. That's not to say there aren't a lot of great power tools out there for power users, but you really need to know what you're doing with those things. Otherwise, you start to get yourself in trouble. When I started doing some of these tweaks to, say, my iPhoto libraries and trying to have multiple libraries and stuff like that, it just made upgrading and transitioning that more difficult. I had to know all the little quirks of my own operating system, and these are all things that I introduced. If I just do it the Apple way, guess what? Upgrades work seamlessly. They work easily because Apple has known variables that they can program against. And I'm seeing this more and more where it's the power users that are having trouble with upgrading, but those people who have stuck to the standard operating system and programs and stuff like that have a much more friendly experience. And I think that's what Apple is trying to get to. I mentioned in a recent episode, this kind of came up too, because I mentioned in a recent episode and I got an email about the fact that I use Spotlight now as my application launcher. And many people have pointed out there's a bunch of great third-party application launcher tools and type application launcher type tools out there. Things like Alfred, which is a free download on the Mac App Store, which is a really great application for doing this stuff. Quicksilver, Launch Bar, these are all great apps. At the end of the day, Spotlight does what I need it to do. It's built in, and I don't have to add an extra layer of stuff on my Mac. So I've kind of stuck with Spotlight, and it works for me. I don't need those extra geeky features, and if I ever do, I know that those applications are out there for me. But what I realized when I sat down to try and analyze that decision, you know, why don't I go with a more powerful tool? I'm a power user. Why am I not using something more powerful like Alfred or Launch Bar, something like that, or Launcher Bar, something like that? And I realized that more and more what I'm trying to do is make experience-based technology decisions rather than the geek-based one. As a geek, I want to get in and I want to tweak everything and I want to do all the cool stuff and I want to like understand everything and mess around with stuff and tinker, right? We want to do that. But we can get lost in trying to make a better tool, trying to make our Macs better, and lose sight of the actual goal, which is to have a tool that we can use to make really cool stuff. So if all we need is a hammer to drive in the nail, do we really need to figure out a million other ways to make a better hammer that does exactly the same thing, accomplishes the same task? And I'm starting to try and think about stuff that way. And I think Apple is trying to do that also. I think we're recognizing that sometimes good enough is enough. You know, if if you have a cell phone that takes a really good picture, it doesn't really matter if it's 5 megapixels or 8 megapixels or 27 megapixels. If you're happy with the result and it gets you to the point of being able to put that on your Facebook page more easily or share it with somebody more easily, then that's the ultimate goal. If you can make a video call without having to think about it, that's the thing. You don't need to know that it's using this video codec or that video codec, or that the average person doesn't. I know as geeks, I'm speaking in big generalizations here, so just go with me on this. But I think as geeks, we get mired and caught up in all this little stuff. So you can I think what's happening at this point when we're seeing these arguments about these power tools kind of going away or being dumbed down or consumerified or turned into iOS type things, that it's too simple, that Apple's kind of saying you can fight it or you can embrace it, but this is the direction we're going in. And if you don't like it, then more and more Apple seems to be willing to say, well, there's other alternatives out there for you and you're happy to go with those. And it's hard to hear for us really die-hard, die-in-the-wool Apple fans, but more and more, what I'm encouraging people to do is kind of have open eyes and just recognize that all those layers are still there. The power is under the hood. Apple might be hiding it at deeper, deeper levels, so we're going to have to dig down deeper to get to the stuff that we want to as geeks, but that's the whole point, right? We're geeks and we can figure it out. For everybody else, they're going to have a better, more seamless, more reliable experience, and they're going to enjoy using their Macs a lot more and move over to the Mac because they're frustrated with the experience on the PC. It's a negative experience, and Apple wants to build positive experiences, even if those positive experiences that work for everybody else might become a little bit more frustrating for the rest of us. So that's a philosophy I'm taking. I don't know if it's going to work out. Maybe I'm totally wrong. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you think I'm on the right track here, or if you totally disagree with me, send me some emails, send me some comments. But that was just some stuff that I was thinking about as I was going through emails and reading stories and stuff like that. So I guess along the lines of that being totally geeky stuff, one of the things that I like to do and find out about are these little kind of hidden things inside the operating systems. Call them Easter eggs, call them little tricks, like the deep kind of tricks that not everybody knows about, some of the history and some of the little funky things that you can find in the operating system. Well, Cult of Mac had a piece this week that pointed out a new profile image that is in Lion Air. At least they thought it was new. I don't remember seeing this there before. But there is a new... So when you set up the operating system, you know how you can pick those default user pictures that Apple provides? It's one of those pictures, and it's of a vinyl record, you know, an album. Remember those things? Old vinyl album. And if you actually look really closely at the tracks that are on that record, in that icon, in that image, it's actually a whole bunch of classic Steve Jobs catchphrases from his keynotes. So track one is magic, track two is revolution, track three is the classic boom, and I really love that track. Great, great listen. And then track four is unbelievable. And if you want to actually see this for yourself, the place you can find this in the operating system is if you go into the main library folder off the root of your hard drive, so not your home user library folder, that one that's now hidden that you have to use the, you know, hold down the option key when you go under the Go menu in the Finder to get to. Remember that tip? No, this one, you go to the library folder off the root of your hard drive, and then inside there you'll see a user pictures folder. And then inside that, there's an instruments folder, and look for the file, the image file called turntable.tiff. You can open that in preview or use the quick look feature in Mac OS X. Just tap the space bar after selecting it and see that image. You can even blow it up nice and big, and then you can see all those individual tracks. So that's really cool. Kind of similar to some of the other Easter eggs we've seen in past versions of the operating system. A classic one, if you're not aware of it, is the text edit icon. If you get in there and really look at the text that's on the text edit document, or the text document that's featured on that icon, it's the text from the Here's to the Crazy Ones ad that Apple produced many years back now, I guess it was. I have to go back and look up the date of that commercial, but one of my favorite Apple commercials of all time, to be sure. But cool little Easter egg discovered in Mac OS X Lion, and thanks to Cult of Mac for pointing that one out. Now, I can't remember specifically what I was doing, but I received an email from somebody. I was doing some research, and I was looking in my utilities folder in Mac OS X Lion, And totally unrelated to that, I suddenly noticed that there was this new podcasting application that jumped out at me. I think most likely because I am a podcaster, so I'm always interested in what's going on with podcasting. But I've known for a long time that macOS 10 and macOS 10 Server had this support for this whole podcast publishing system that Apple's built into its server products. And I think I remember hearing about some of that stuff coming into Lion. Now, in the past, I think there was an application that showed up in Snow Leopard, if I'm remembering properly, called the Podcast Capture application that tied into the server application. But this one that I noticed was something called Podcast Publisher. And it is new in Lion, and it's a little application that lets you create podcasts and then send them off to the server. But it turns out, as I was playing around with it, you don't just have to send them off to the server. So Apple says, using Podcast Publisher, you can record videos of yourself, your computer display, or a narrated screen recording and organize these into unique podcasts. So if you want to find this application, just go into your applications folder under utilities and you'll see Podcast Publisher if you have OS X Lion. And if you launch it, what you'll notice is it's kind of a single window interface, and you can create the new podcast button to create a new podcast, and you can create multiple podcasts and manage them in there. It kind of has this corkboard style interface, a little bit reminiscent of the icon actually for iWeb, which might be significant. When I started looking at this and analyzing it, I think it may be indicating a future direction that Apple is moving in. But let me finish telling you about the application. So you have a little corkboard, and once you've thrown up your podcast, you can name it and then start adding episodes to it. So there's a little post-it note that shows up. You click the post-it note and you can add an episode. Now, by default, it adds what Apple calls a movie episode, meaning that you're either going to do a screencast or capture some video from the built-in iSight on your Mac. But you can also choose from the little menu on the main screen adding an audio podcast if you want to just do audio. And then it gives you a real simple interface for doing the recording. So in movie mode, you get a little button. There's a toggle actually at the bottom where you can switch between capturing iSight video or your desktop. So if you want to do a screen capture, you can do that. And when you hit the record button in the interface, it does the 3-2-1 countdown, and then you just simply start recording. And then when you finish recording, you press the button again, and it adds your episode. And that's the whole thing, pretty much. Not a lot of features here. There's no advanced editing that I could find. There's no separate audio track. So whatever you record when you're talking into your mic that's built into your Mac, or you can select any input source that you would have connected, that's what you get. And same thing on the audio. It just records the audio. You can kind of trim the ends. You get the classic little yellow selection with the handles on the end that you can trim, a lot like what you get in QuickTime. QuickTime X has a similar feature. It was very reminiscent of that when I was playing around with it. But that's it. You have your episode, and then you get some share options. And what is different about this one versus the other podcast application is you don't just have to send your recording out to the server. It has options for sending right into iTunes, into Mail, or saving it out to your desktop. And it looks like what it generates is a .mov file, an H.264 video format for the video, AAC 44.1 kilobit per second stereo audio on the audio side. It also has the ability to send out to podcast library or a remote workflow, which are the server components that you can send to. And on that side, I looked into a little bit of what the podcast library was. What was interesting about all of this was there wasn't a lot of information about Podcast Producer. I found some sites mentioning that it was a feature coming in Lion, but couldn't find much information even on Apple's website about how all this stuff works or how it links together. But the bit of information I found about Podcast Library is that it is an application built into Lion's server, and Apple says it's a centralized location for hosting and publishing podcasts uploaded from Podcast Publisher. Podcast Library provides long-term storage for content and automatically generates the appropriate RSS feeds based on the podcast and episode names, title, metadata, provided by the podcast publisher. So that indicates you can do a few other things in Podcast Publisher. You can choose get info on a podcast to put in metadata, including things like the title, the description, album art, any categories that you might use in iTunes, the keywords. You just have to click the show advanced button in the Git info window to see all the different fields that you can actually fill out. You can edit and add metadata to individual podcasts. It has a really interesting way to do that. When you've added a podcast to your, or an episode, excuse me, to your podcast, what happens is you get a little push pin and a little icon sort of tacked on the board for each episode that you have. I don't know how it does it in terms of laying it out. It just seemed kind of haphazard. But each one gets a little push pin. And if you click on the push pin, you can get info on that episode and then add the metadata for that episode. You can also delete by pushing on that little push pin as well. So you can manage multiple podcasts. You can import media from the file menu or use your media browser. So you can bring in stuff from other programs, but each media file becomes its own individual episode. Once again, there's no kind of editing. You can't combine multiple things together. You can't cut and paste, you know, a bit of audio from here and a bit of audio from there and put that together in an episode. Each one is an individual thing. So very, very limited in terms of the functionality. You can also import shows. This was interesting, from an existing podcast RSS feed URL. So I was able to plug in the Maccast URL, and it gave me a list of all of the episodes that were in my podcast feed, and I could check or uncheck individual episodes and import them right into the podcast publisher application. Once again, all I could do once I had the audio in there was trim the ends, and I couldn't add anything like the album art or chapters and stuff like that I do for my AAC podcast. Interestingly, though, it was supported in terms of the playback because those things were already in there. They did show up when I imported it into the podcast publisher application. So I'm not really sure how useful this application is going to be. It might be good if you want to do a quick screencast for somebody and you want to use an application and you don't want to use QuickTime 10, you could use the podcast publisher application. It'd be very good for doing that sort of thing. I got a little more curious to dig a little bit deeper to figure out what was going on under the hood. So I did try and find where the actual data was stored on my system. And it looks like where all of the stuff is stored is in the podcast publisher library file, very similar to your iTunes library file or your iPhoto library file. You'll find it in your home folder inside the library folder under application support in the podcast publisher folder. And it is a package. So if you do the classic thing where you right click or control click on the podcast publisher library file, you can choose show package contents and kind of dive into what's inside there. And inside there, there's actually a collections folder which contains all the individual podcasts and the episodes. Now, interestingly, what I found out was that the episodes are .ite files, iTunes extra files. And the only other place I've ever heard of an iTunes extra is with respect to movies that you can purchase through the iTunes store, those movie extras. And so that kind of got me thinking that while there's not much functionality here in 1.0, this could be possibly the thing that we've been hearing about as the replacement for something like iDVD. Apple seems to be building this whole workflow going from content creation through editing and publishing all the way through distribution via the iTunes store for all kinds of media content. And we've heard that Apple has these thoughts or might be working on some sort of software to allow you to do that. So maybe this is just Apple experimenting around and playing with it. Maybe this is the beginnings of something like that. I would imagine the tool would allow you to do ebooks, EPUBs, TV shows, movies, podcasts, everything kind of all in one application. So it does build on my theory that Apple might be trying to put together this system. And I think, you know, ultimately, this could be really great for content creators. If you have an idea for a show, you would be able to use Apple products and technology all the way from the birth of the project, all the way through completion, distribution, and even getting payment. You know, Apple's going to take its 30% cut probably off the top, but you would be able to do your own show all through Apple technology. And, you know, they've got that massive data center. So they have systems and seems like they're building an infrastructure to allow this to happen. Now we just need the tools. And I'm just wondering if Podcast Publisher isn't the kind of seeds of that tool. Again, not a lot here, but you might want to take a look at it and play around with it. At least for me, it was an interesting find, and I hadn't heard anything about it before I kind of discovered it there in my utilities folder. And then I have one final little quick tip for you, and this one came via Macworld. I read this over on Macworld's website, and I've been using full screen mode for my applications a lot in Lion. And the main reason probably is because I use a 15-inch monitor. I've had this conversation with a couple people who, if you have large monitors, or especially if you have a dual screen setup, the full screen view is probably going to be very frustrating for you in Lion. The reason being is that you can't have two full screen applications open on two different screens, or even one application full screen on one screen and then have, say, your desktop open on another screen, which would be a really great way to work. Sort of once you full screen an application, you have it full screen on one screen and the other screen goes black. So not very useful. But with a small monitor, it's great for having a single view of an application and then using the new swipe gestures to switch between your desktops. And I'm really, really enjoying that. One thing that I hadn't noticed, though, is that you don't have access to your dock. And I don't do the whole dock hiding thing, but a lot of people have been wondering why, when I get close to the edge of my screen where my dock is, why doesn't it pop up? Because I have it set to auto hide and auto pop up. It should do that in full screen mode, and that way I can use the stuff that's in my dock. Well, Macworld pointed out that you can actually get the dock to pop up. You just have to do a little bit of extra work. So what you do is you move your cursor all the way over to the edge where your dock is when you're in a full screen application, and then just make that same motion again. So once it gets to the edge and kind of stops, push again into the edge of your screen, either with your mouse by pushing in that direction or just swiping with your finger on the trackpad, and magically the dock will pop up into full screen mode. I thought that was pretty cool and hadn't run across that tip yet, so I wanted to share that with you. So that's going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, you can get cash for your old electronics quick and easy without the hassles of auctions or classified sites. You can find details and get information at gazelle.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, great back-to-school application. As I was mentioning earlier, you can check out their software, get more information and details at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, three applications that I use and absolutely love. Get more information on those products and free trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSafe Mac. Deep Freeze has been updated to version 5.0 and adds Lion compatibility. So check that stuff out. Get trials and information at Furonix.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. If you'd like to support the show even further, you can become a MacCast member. You can find details on how to sign up and all of the different payment options I offer month to month. You can go 6 months or 1 year, all for about $4 a month. You get additional content of the MacCast, a lot of hints and tips and tricks and stuff like that. I'm covering a lot of Lion stuff, so if you want to check that out, you can get details over at member.maccast.com, and I'd love to have you as a MacCast member. And if you're already a member, thank you for subscribing. I really appreciate your support. If you'd like to get a hold of the MacCast, you have a comment, you have a question, something you want to hear covered on a future episode, please send any emails, any audio comments to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9 is the voicemail line. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is the MacCast. And if you want to send an audio comment, I love getting audio comments because I can play those on the show and it becomes a little bit more interactive. You can use that new podcast producer or podcast publisher tool to send those along. That's a great way to do it. Or just use the built-in recorder on your iOS device. It's another great way, and you can email right from there. So I look forward to receiving those. Also, if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website at maccast.com. And while you're there, check out the forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. Look forward to seeing you online and hearing from you soon. And that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.